UK Wine Show, show number 105. Charles Metcalf and Mike Florence on the International Wine Challenge. On this week's show, we cast a spotlight into wine pricing, the International Wine Challenge, which is, according to Mike Florence,
we consider ourselves to be the largest competition in the world.
And in the news, London's new mayor to ban booze, Chinese wine hits our shelves, and English Wine Week gains momentum.
G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 105 for the 22nd of May, 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Mike Florence, the General Manager of the International Wine Challenge, and Charles Metcalf, instigator and one of the judging chairmen. We find out about the International Wine Challenge and some of the issues facing such a big competition. And in the spotlight, we talk about wine pricing. Is wine good value for money? And how is the price of wine determined? But before we get into that and deal with the dreaded monster of wine pricing, let's have the news with our very own Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. In his first week as Mayor of London, Boris Johnson has announced plans to ban alcohol on the capital's public transport network. The new rules will ban drinking as well as carrying open containers of alcohol and will cover the buses and tube, Docklands Light Railway and tram services. The move was one of Boris Johnson's key manifesto pledges during his campaign to become mayor, and he said it was central to cutting crime and reducing antisocial behaviour. London's Transport Commissioner Peter Hendy supported the move by saying that cutting out boozing on public transport will be welcomed by passengers and staff. The ban will take effect from the 1st of June this year.
Crikey, Jane, only a couple of days left to drink White Lightning on the tube. What will the world come to? Well, virtually nothing. Bit of a tension-grabbing headline, with virtually no chance of enforcing it, especially given that most of the drinking I see on the tube happens around sports games and late at night when there's no one around. But good on the blonde mop for getting on the bandwagon and delivering an easy-to-say, impossible-to-police headline. What's coming up next, Jane?
Well, another attention-grabbing headline, Chris. Supermarket chain Morrison's has started to sell Chinese wine, claiming to be the first UK supermarket to do so. Morrison's has introduced two wines from the northwest of China to its stores, a Silk Road Cabernet Sauvignon and a Chardonnay, which both retail at £5.99 and have been made with the help of a Bordeaux winemaker. They're produced from an ethically run vineyard and winery tended by local families with government support. Grant Eastwood, Morrison's licensed trades director, believes China has the technology and the ability to make wine that can compete with the world's best-selling wine-producing countries. But trading manager and master of wine Arabella Woodrow described China's climate as difficult for grape growing, being very dry with high summer temperatures. That said, she predicts that with quality continually improving, Chinese wine will be able to shake off its novelty image in the UK. Who knows, maybe China will come from nowhere to take the UK market by storm, just as Australia did in the early 90s. Do you think they can do it, Chris?
I think China has a long road to hoe. While I don't pretend to be overcompetent on Chinese wines, we do taste some of them in our tastings. And to be true, it's purely for novelty value. They do not perform on price or quality. The wine we try is called Noble Dragon Red from Shandong Province in China, 2005. We have around 76 ratings from it from our tastings, and 28% think it's yuck or not to their liking. Now, the wine isn't great, but it's not that bad. But at £8 a bottle, it certainly underperforms on its price. And is more about novelty, I think. China could be a great wine-producing region, though, with the likes of viticulturist Richard Smart and wine writer Robert Joseph both thinking it has a great future. But at the moment, the wines are at best average and expensive. I actually have an interview with Richard Smart on China coming up in a few months' time, so do keep your eye out for that. Jane, what about English Wine Week? Isn't it coming up soon?
Yep, the countrywide campaign to promote English wines and vineyards kicks off on Saturday the 24th of May. And with growing interest in English wine, the celebration of our homegrown grape is gathering momentum. A host of activities are being offered by vineyards across the country, including tours, tastings and special events. And wine merchants, restaurants and pubs will also be running their own promotions featuring English wines. The initiative is being organised by English wine producers and co-sponsored by Food from Britain. The events range from tutored blind tastings to compare English sparkling wine with champagne, that's going on at Ridgeview Wine Estate in Sussex, to rather less wine-focused pastimes, such as belly dancing at Sharpham Vineyard in Devon. The highlight for me, though, has to be fizz and fish with Bob and Rick at Rickstein's Fish and Chip Shop Cafe in Padstow, Cornwall, with Bob Lindow of Camel Valley. I think there's a podcast with Bob coming up, isn't there, Chris?
No, we've actually interviewed Sam Lindow. He's the winemaker.
Okay. Well, a full rundown of all that's going on during English Wine Week is available at their website, englishwineweek.co.uk. And English Wine Producers has also published a map of the vineyards of England and Wales, which you can find at englishwineproducers.com. And finally, for those who want to learn more about our wine, there's three books being published this summer. The first one is Grape Britain by David Harvey. There's also Stephen Skelton's The Wines of Britain and Ireland, which will be available later in the year, and a book on the vineyards of England and Wales by David Moore and Philip Williamson. They're the guys who wrote the Wine Behind the Label series.
Great stuff, Jane. I have an old edition of Stephen Skelton's Wines of Britain and Ireland, which is a very good reference book, but certainly not a book for general reading. I've interviewed Stephen about his new book at the English Trade Fair in London 3 weeks ago, and I'll release that show later on in the year. And I'll also hopefully review those three books as they get released over summer during the spotlight. For the listeners, do go and have a look at what's going on around England during English Wine Week. And in the run-up to English Wine Week, we're going to be interviewing Three Choirs, one of the last big UK wineries to be on our show. Is there any more news, Jane?
Yep, there's just a reminder for those in the trade that it's London International Wine Fair next week, from the 20th to the 22nd of May at XL. There's going to be about 1,300 stands and 20,000 wines to explore, and a packed schedule of tastings and seminars. To register, go to londonwinefair.com, but remember, all visitors must be professionally connected to the wine and spirits industry. That's it from me, but don't forget, all these stories are available in full at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. The London International Wine Fair is not only one of the biggest fairs in the world, it also had a timely boost this week, with stories in the wine press about New World Wine Producing holding talks on pulling out of France's biannual Vinexpo. Seemingly, after people have been boycotting it in the last couple of times, more are thinking about staging an alternative to it next year. The main reason, according to Decanter magazine, is that it appears to many to be that Vinexpo is biased towards French wines, and Bordeaux in particular. And along with air conditioning issues on the halls on 2003, which affected the New Zealand, Australian and South African stands so they couldn't actually do any business because it was so hot, and in 2005, Wines of South Africa, New Zealand Wine Growers and Australia Wine Export Council all pulled out of the 2005 event. I think South Africans would have wished they'd pulled out of the 2007 event as well, when French customs held up their wine for 6 days while waiting to, well, just waiting really. And in the end, Wines of South Africa had no wine for the first days of the show. Not a good thing to do when you're trying to show your wines at an event. Many producers have had enough, and perhaps Vinexpo is about to lose its status as the world's biggest wine show. Many have had enough and are trying to negotiate a new show on more neutral grounds. If you think, as a consumer listening to the show, that you don't really care about this, well, these big trade shows are where small buyers get to taste a lot of wines, and they're essential for many in the trade to keep on top of things. The big retail chains don't need them as much, as the buying teams don't need to meet the producers. The producers are already queuing up to see them. But all the small quality merchants do need to go to these big events and source wine. And it's the smaller guys in the wine trade that create such a vibrant market. Otherwise, we'd all be drinking the same wine, probably in a supermarket 2-for-1 offer. Speaking of pricing, next up we have the spotlight, and this week we're looking at the price of wine. In part one, we try and get the big picture. Wine, to different people, means different things. To some, it's an occasional luxury. To others, it's part of everyday life. A day is not the same until they've had a glass of wine to finish it off. Both approaches are as good as each other. In fact, two people can approach the same wine with two completely different attitudes. What is a luxury wine for one person is just run-of-the-mill for others. That said, there appears to be two very distinct pricing mechanisms operating in the UK to set the price of wines. These are quality versus price and supply and demand. Quality versus price, as you'd expect, is about the quality of the wine improves, the price will go up as well. Supply versus demand, as demand increases for a wine, it becomes more difficult to source, and so the price of the wine goes up. In any wine, there's a mixture of the two. For example, some very cheap wines, maybe even cheaper than the quality might normally suggest, if they're from an unpopular region or an unpopular style. For example, a Hungarian Oaky Chardonnay may be sold at a discount irrespective of the quality because Hungary is not a well-known region, and let's face it, Oaky Chardonnays are no longer fashionable. While a top-end Bordeaux will have a price that has less to do about the quality of the wine and more to do with the chateau producing the wine. In both these cases, the price is really set by quality price, which is then adjusted up and down by supply and demand. Generally speaking, wines in the £5 to £10 price point on the high street, the pricing is dominated by price-quality relationships, while wines over about £20 to £25 are more dominated by supply and demand relationships. And in between those two prices, you get a mixture. But what are the fundamental factors determining the quality versus price? While quality wine is often referred to, it's rarely defined. There is an argument that claims that there's no way of really determining quality other than examining the purpose for which the wine is to be put and its value for money. Experienced tasters have their own varying ways of analysing the excellence of what they drink, but the following is a good rule of thumb. Intensity of flavour. Ideally, wine should have a good fruit flavour on the palate and should be balanced by concentrated aromas. Most winemakers achieve this by not allowing their vines to produce too much fruit. This concentrates the flavour into a smaller number of grapes, producing more concentrated wines. Balance. The structural elements in the wine should be in balance. The structural elements being sweetness, acidity, tannins, alcohol, and fruit intensity, fruit flavour. Balance is achieved by the winery by matching the style of the wine with the grapes that the winemaker has to work with. Well-balanced wines are more enjoyable and show good quality winemaking and great growing skills. Some wines are more about balance than fruit intensity. For example, a lot of northern Italian whites are more about balance and working with food than trying to overpower the food with some sort of fruit. Length. How long the taste lasts in your mouth after you swallowed. A lot of mediocre and commercial wines, the flavour will fade after 2 to 5 seconds. But good quality wines will last between 10 and 15 seconds, or even longer. Length, again, is linked to concentration and intensity of flavour, and you can measure it by taking a slug of the wine, swishing it around, swallowing the wine, and leave your mouth open. I actually chew, because you want to get the flavour up into your nose so you can feel that length and feel the fruit. The final leg in pricing is complexity. Complexity refers to the layers of flavour in a wine. A simple Syrah, for example, may only have one or two fruit flavours, such as black fruits, while a more complex wine may have spice, coffee, or tar. The flavours in a wine come from three sources, and these are fruit, the winemaking process, and ageing. Simple wines are fruit-driven, and the flavours come from the grapes. But during the winemaking process, the wine can pick up other flavours. For example, if you keep the wine into a barrel, it may pick up vanilla or coconut flavours. When you're making the barrel, you sometimes heat the inside of the barrel to bend the wood, and that can give a toasty, sometimes smoky aromas to the wine. After the wine's been made, and in the bottle, wines do age, and they develop what we call secondary aromas. These aren't so much fruit flavours, they're more earthy, savoury aromas for reds, and more honeyed, sometimes nutty aromas for white wines. For a wine to develop complexity, aging or expensive winemaking techniques are required, and both add cost to the wine. And a wine with lots of complexity, well, they're more expensive. That ends this week's look at pricing. I'll continue with pricing over the next couple of weeks. Next week we're going to break down what makes up the price of a bottle of wine. And after we've looked at pricing, we're going to have a look at this month's poll, which for you guys is the first time you've heard it. The question is this: which of the following do you prefer to drink when going out? Still or sparkling wine? Beer, cider, spirits-based drinks or cocktails, or another drink. Do have your say. It's all really interesting to see what people like or dislike. For example, personally, if I'm going to the pub, I tend to drink beer. And while at a restaurant, I do tend to drink wine. After a wine tasting, where I might have tasted a load of wines, all I really want is a simple, refreshing lager. And that's pretty much how I felt when I'd come back after tasting 100 wines at the International Wine Challenge. I did go back a couple of days later, and I spent a day talking with Sam Harrop, the man in charge of the wine vaults at the International Wine Challenge, and I've got some shows with him coming out in the next couple of weeks. I also did an interview with Charles Metcalf and Mike Florence about the International Wine Challenge. Charles is the panel judge and one of the people who started the competition with Robert Joseph, while Mike Florence is the show's general manager. With the results coming out on the 20th of May, I thought it was a good time to have a chat and talk about the International Wine Challenge with Charles and Mike. Let's have a listen to what they have to say. Hi, I'm here with Mike Florence and Charles Metcalf. Mike, you're the general manager, and Charles, you're the co-chairman of the International Wine Challenge.
That's right, yeah.
How did the show start?
It started in a very modest way. Robert Joseph and I were running a magazine which at that stage was called What Wine, in a stable that included What Car, What Van, What Hi-Fi, What Wheelbarrow. And we just found ourselves with a couple of pages to fill one issue. And we're scratching our heads a bit, and we came up with the idea of doing something on English wine. We'd tasted some nice English wines in the sort of recent past. And we thought, well, perhaps we could put together a tasting event which would show them to good effect. And so we got together the best English wines we could find with a raft of other famous wines from other countries, other wine countries, you know, really famous names such as Blue Nun, Piat d'Or, I think Black Tar was in there, you know, some big names. And we held our tasting with as many international tasters as we could, all resident in London, but we had a Bulgarian, an Italian, a Spaniard, a German, you know, as many as we could think of. And the English wines won. We filled our two pages. Questions were asked in the Houses of Parliament about this miraculous competition where English wines had triumphed. And the wine industry came back to us after this and said, look, you know, when you have competitions, you're usually allowed to choose your own team. Perhaps next time you do this, we could choose the wines we send you. And we said, fine, not really realizing that there was going to be a repeat of this, but... and so they sent lots of wines, and one thing has grown. And for the last, I would say, 4 years, we've been around the 9,000.
Yeah, probably
four or five years.
Yeah, probably 5 to 8 years, actually. Now we're above the 9,000.
Yeah. We sort of chugged along at about 6,000 for a few years before that, and then we took a bit of a leap and have been up at this really pretty substantial size.
Is that the most wines in any competition?
That's our understanding, yes. We consider ourselves to be the largest competition in the world.
I think there was once a one-day competition that was held somewhere in France where they tasted more wines in one day with literally about 1,000 tasters than we taste in our 2 weeks. But that was just a sort of one-off event held for the Guinness Book of Records. We do it every year as seriously as we can. We're not interested in the Guinness Book of Records, and I think we are the largest on a regular basis.
No, I think it's safe to say. But, you know, it's more about the integrity of the competition than the size, we believe. So it's certainly, as far as our judging process is concerned, we consider ourselves to be the most rigorous of all competitions that are staged throughout the world.
And how does the judging work? It seems to be like a two-cup process, is it?
Absolutely. We decided that we got more refined results, you know, better results, if we whisked through the whole of the entry in week one and then went back to award the specific medals that were going to be won by wines in week two. So that's exactly what we do. In the first week, 5 days of the first week, we taste all 9,000, however many hundred wines have been entered. And we just ask our tasters to tell us whether they're out, whether they're going to get a commendation, and in those two cases not play any further part in the contest, or whether they're worthy of a medal, in which case they're retasted in week two, where we do it we try and ask people to slow down, really think about the wines, not just give big marks to the sort of big showy wines, but to look for the subtle, elegant wines as well. And, you know, we do the actual medal awarding in that second week. And I think that works very well. I don't know of anywhere else that does it like that. The other thing we do, which is different from a lot of the other wine competitions that I've judged at throughout the world, this is more on the Australian and New Zealand model, is that we We discuss everything. We don't just give points, add them up, and divide by the number of tasters. And I think that's a much, much more successful way of judging as well.
I found I came in and did some judging on Monday for the first time, which was brilliant. I found it was a really good learning opportunity, actually, because there was just dialogue, and we had people in my team that were really very knowledgeable, and we got a chance to talk about it. And I actually learned quite a bit about some weird grape varieties and all sorts of stuff that I wouldn't normally get a chance to try.
Good. I mean, you know, we do find that we try and get in judges from all sorts of different countries all over the world. So, I mean, we have people here today from Italy, from Portugal, from Spain, from France. And Mike's just shown me this bit of paper where we've actually got 425 different tasters participating, not all at once. We have about 100, 120 tasters a day. But we've got from countries such as Austria, Belgium, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Italy, the USA, Japan. We've got a few Japanese judges in today. And the Japanese sommeliers, the standard of knowledge of Japanese sommeliers is absolutely phenomenal. Portugal, France, Australia, as well as from New Zealand.
Obviously, you do your two cuts. And how many wines sort of get rejected? Or you put them into commendable and out. Is that right?
That's right. Those are the ones that are only make an appearance in the first week and don't reappear in week two.
All right, so if you get a commendable, you're not really getting a second chance. How many wines come through for the second week of judging?
We should probably just make a point that they do get a second chance, and they do get a second chance via our co-chairman. In round one, they will review every wine that our panel of judges have deemed to be commendable or an out. Then the co-chairman, if they see a wine which they perhaps think is perhaps medal-worthy, they will then call upon another co-chairman to make a group decision that they are happy to raise that wine to a medal standard and therefore put it through to round two.
Oh, okay. And who gets to try all these wines that were rejected?
We do. I mean, it's the five of us. I have to say, it's not a lot of fun in the first week, Chris, to be honest, because we are only tasting the ones that
Dross.
have been rejected or at most given a commended. We don't taste any of the medal wines in the first week at all. But, you know, we get to taste them in the second week, so that's good.
Okay. So, again, back to the question, how many make it through to the second round?
At this point in time, for this year, we're working on about 45% at this point in time. We did some figures this morning, and it was just a tick over 45%.
Even including all those horrible ones from yesterday, Mike?
Even including
those
horrible ones from yesterday.
Wow, that really surprised me. We had an awful lot of pretty rough wines thrown at us yesterday.
Excellent. That's quite high, though, isn't it? That's quite good.
Yeah, I mean, that's not to say that in round two that they will be deemed medal-worthy. The judges still have the opportunity to then either throw the wines out, give them a commended, or assign them their various medals.
Okay, but you've got half the number of wines, so you can spend a lot more time on the wines.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. We try and sort of work around 50 wines per day per panel for the group of four or five judges. So.
We tasted a lot more than that on Monday.
That's correct. So that's for round two. For round one, when the decision is, you know, is it out, commended, or is it medal worthy, then, yeah, you're working closer to sort of 90 to 100 wines per day.
That's quite good, though, because you'll end up with wines that are of a higher standard, so you can pick the better qualities.
That's the hope. And also in round two, we're asking our tasters to write tasting notes, which we don't need in round one, because the wines that are chucked out aren't going to be published anywhere. The wines that are commended get into the publication, but not with tasting notes.
How do you prepare the wine for it? Because I noticed on Monday some of the reds were actually quite cold, which isn't necessarily the best condition for red wines.
Come on, Chris, you've got a pair of warm hands. You can cup the glass in your hands and warm it up, for goodness sake.
Between my thighs.
Yours or any friendly person nearby. No, to be perfectly honest, you look down at that floor down there. We're sitting on a balcony overlooking the floor where we keep all the wines.
Thousands.
And there are literally thousands of wines. I mean, if you say we've got, it's nearer 10 than 9,000. And you know, there are just lines stretching as far as not as the eye can see, but to the end of this big space. And as Mike says, about 45,000 wines down there. I'm afraid we can go as far as chilling our sparkling wines, but that's it really. We try and get the people who run the building to get a good ambient temperature for tasting. And my feeling has always been, excuse me, that it's better to taste too cool than too hot. Because if you've got a wine that has been heated too much, it's much more of a business to discern the various subtleties than it is if it's served a bit cool, and then you have to think about sort of warming it up a bit with your hands.
And also, most tasters taste ambient anyway. I mean, when I was doing my WCT, we tasted whites and reds at the same temperature, so I suppose you get used to it after a while.
You know, to be honest, as an experienced taster, you can make a bit of a mental leap and think, if this is a white wine and it's being served warmer than I would normally serve it were I serving it at home, you know, you can make a leap to think what would happen to that wine if it was a few degrees cooler.
What about letting the wines breathe? Do you let any of the wines breathe?
We get the cork out, don't we, Mike?
And pretty then they... much. I mean, there are certain styles, I mean, such as your vintage ports, which we make an effort to decant. We see that as being critical. That gives them, obviously, a decent amount of breathing time. You know, as Charles is saying, time is not necessarily on our side. It's quite important that we keep the wines flowing as quickly and efficiently and as effectively as possible. So, unfortunately, as far as letting the wines breathe, it's perhaps not quite...
But, you know, in defence of that, I agree absolutely with what Mike said, and time is a real pressure for us. But in defence of that, how many people at home will open a bottle of red wine, pour it into a decanter, unless, of course, they're ashamed of it and wish to pretend it's better than it is, and actually let a wine breathe? Most people that I know get the wine, they pull the cork out, they pour it into the glasses, and they drink it. And yeah, some of them even sniff it. I mean, I spend quite a lot of time smelling wine compared to most of the wine drinkers I know.
You've got a thing called two strikes and you're out. This is with faulty wines. We're going to be talking with Sam next week about wine faults, but what's the reason for that?
The reason for that is that we feel people are sending us four bottles of each sample. And the idea behind four bottles is that the you have two bottles possible for the first round, two bottles for the second round if it gets through to the second round. Now, there are all sorts of reasons, but the principal problems we have where we would call for another bottle are problems of cork taint or of oxidation, because those are two things where we feel another bottle might perform better. But once out of four bottles, you've got a fault rate of 50% on a particular wine, I don't feel happy about recommending that bottle to people to drink. You know, if we're saying one in two bottles you're going to buy is going to be a duff bottle, I don't think that's much of a recommendation.
Sure, no, that makes sense. What sort of value does the award have? You know, if I win a gold medal or a trophy or something like that, you know, what does that do to my bottom line? Is it important?
I think it's absolutely critical, and it's really why we're here at the end of the day. I mean, we have stats, you know, such as, you know, well, a specific wine that a couple of years ago won a trophy. Without any price increase on this wine, stayed at its regular price, sales rose by over 730%. 6 months later, they were still up by 150%. So we believe that what we're offering the trade is certainly benefiting them as well as the consumer.
And I think that example that Mike cites is a very good one, because the first thing that I would say in response to your question, Chris, is that an award is only as valuable as what you make of it as a wine producer or a wine merchant. If you win a gold medal and you tuck your gold medal winning wine away on some shelf, tell nobody about it, it probably won't mean anything. You know, you might, in passing conversation, mention to one or two customers in your shop, oh yes, this wine got a gold medal, and they might buy something. If you shout it from the rooftops, it can make a huge difference. And that's exactly what this company did. It happens to be a large supermarket. And they shouted it. They took big ads in papers. And it hugely increased their sales. But the point is that, as Mike says, sales were still up 150% from where they had been after the brouhaha had died down. And you know, that I think is where we are benefiting the consumer as well as the retailer or producer, because we've drawn their attention to something that is frankly a better wine.
What about the costs of entering a competition like this? It's obviously that started out as quite a sociable wee thing from What Wine, which I don't even know exists anymore, does it?
Well, What Wine was the name that then changed into Wine Magazine. Then it became Wine International, but you are unfortunately right. It's RIP Wine International now. It's sadly, it's laid down its pages.
But the competition lives on, which is quite funny, isn't it? The magazine that spawned it has...
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I think the reality of the situation was it's difficult to produce a wine magazine for consumers and to make a profit, whereas this competition has been, you know, just by the size of it, you can see it has been successful, and touching every piece of wood that I have in within reach, it will continue to be successful and make decent money and benefit all those who participate.
Who owns the competition?
It's a company called William Reed Business Media, who started out in publishing back in, the late 19th century, and have been very much sort of food and drinks focused, but sort of branching out into the exhibitions and events side of things. They've had control of the Wine Challenge for the last three years. Investment in the event has been absolutely fantastic. It's it's taken it to a whole new level now, and you know we're seeing the benefits first and foremost. The quality of the results that we're generating are better than they've ever been before. Investment in our judges is obviously absolutely critical. We have new to this year a panel of 20 chairmen who are with us for the full duration. They're taking control of their panels and working very closely with our chairman to ensure that we're, you know, that we're judging at the right level and at the consistent level that we expect.
Okay, and getting on to how much it costs to enter a bottle of wine?
You're looking at £73.80 plus VAT plus four samples. It does vary if you're an international entrant. It's a little bit more because we cover the cost of their freight. It makes the process a lot easier for them. If all they have is just one set entry fee, we tell them where to send their samples, and then we take care of the rest. It's a much more easier and effective way of doing it.
If you've got international wines coming, you've got all sorts of duty issues.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And obviously, it's critical that we follow all the rules and regulations that are set out by the VAT man, and that way that we can control it a lot more effectively.
And is the competition a profit centre? Does it make money?
Yeah, of course it does. I mean, if it didn't, Chris, it would have gone the sad way of Wine What? International. You know, What Wine / Wine Magazine / Wine International. It was bought by a company who wanted it because it was profitable. And it's profitable because it's, I think, and as Mike says, a well-run operation that offers really good advice to drinkers all over the world.
When I was judging on Monday, and I came in on Monday, I actually suffered from a cold. I was fine for the first three or four
flights. Did you infect anyone?
Just the panel with me. I haven't seen them today. No, it was just the end of a cold. But the first three or four flights, I was fine. And then after that, my nose packed up. I could still get fruit on the mouth, so I was good at balance and finding any problems with the balance of the wine. But I really missed any subtlety on the nose. What happens if a judge comes down with a cold or is off?
Well, I mean, the first answer to that, I guess, is that judge might well choose not to come in. You know, say, look, I know that I'm not going to be as effective a judge as I would normally be, and just stay at home. I'm possibly not telling the boss that he's not actually at the International Wine Challenge and go off and...
Play some golf,
as he might. That is a possibility. But if someone does come in, I mean, I think it would be only sensible to realise shortcomings and tell the panel chairman that, look, I'm not on top form today, a bit blocked. And the panel chair will sort of...
Devalue your opinion.
Well, take that into account when arriving at a consensus.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's what happened to us after I realised. Yeah. I got to a load of Gruner Veltlingers and I was going, these don't smell of anything at all. And I don't expect Gruner to be particularly aromatic, but it...
It's a great pity when, you know, you're looking forward to coming and tasting an event like this and the nose lets you down.
Yeah, it's a bit. I was very disappointed, but these things happen.
Yeah.
Just before we wrap up, I noticed this year you had a big sake tasting. Is that new or...?
We've included the sake category in the last 3 years. Previously, it was part of the International Spirits Challenge, actually. And then we decided, well, it's actually a better fit to be in the International Wine Challenge. So in our first year, we had a couple of entries. and actually, one of which was truly outstanding. In fact, it came away with a trophy. And we thought, hang on a second, there's something that we're missing here. And so we've worked very closely with the Sake Samurai Association in Japan to help build the category to the point now where this year we had 312 sakes entered. Their support has been absolutely crucial to the success of this part of the wine challenge, because they have brought over a number of panel chairmen directly from Japan, who obviously know the category very, very well, yesterday we did our trophy tasting of sake, and the results that we've generated there have been fantastic. And I think they've been actually really quite impressed with the quality that we've managed to introduce into the wine challenge. So
we've had tasters. I wasn't tasting sake myself because it's not a category I know well. But we've had specialists not only from Japan but also from the States, from continental Europe, just coming over to do that category. And I think the results are going to be very exciting and really worthwhile.
Anything you can tell me? This show will be going out just before the show comes out.
Unfortunately, not. I mean, I can tell you that we've got 13 gold medals this year, of which we've managed to. I'm pretty sure we're at 8 trophies. One champion sake. The trophies will be announced mid-June, and the champion sake will be announced at our awards dinner on the 3rd of September.
So we hope you can come along then, Chris.
Brilliant. Sounds good. I'll look forward to my invitation. Yes. All right then, guys. I think we'll wrap it up. I know you've got hundreds of wines to get back to.
Absolutely.
And thank you very much for your time.
Good. Thanks very much.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Charles and Mike. I think it's important to understand how results are worked out so that you can determine how to value a set of results. Next week, we're going to be talking with Martin Folk, winemaker at Three Choirs, one of the last big wineries in the UK to have on the show. I thought it was pretty timely given that we're coming up to English Wine Week, which starts on the 24th of May through to the 1st of June. Do stay tuned and get some great ideas about what you can do for English Wine Week. But just to finish off with, a wee joke. A woman was walking down the street when she was accosted by a particularly dirty, shabbily homeless woman who asked her for a couple of pounds for dinner. The woman looked at her purse, extracted £10 and asked, "If I give you this money, will you buy some wine instead of dinner?" "No, I've stopped drinking years ago," the homeless woman replied. "Then will you use it for shopping instead of buying food?" the woman asked. "No, I don't waste my time shopping," the homeless woman said. "I need to spend all my time trying to stay alive." "Well, will you spend it at a beauty salon instead of food?" the woman asked. "Are you nuts?" replied the homeless woman. "I haven't had my hair done in 20 years. "Well," said the woman, "I'm not going to give you the money. Instead, I'm going to take you out for dinner with my hubby and myself tonight." The homeless woman was astounded. "Won't your husband be furious with you for doing that?" "I know I'm dirty, and I probably smell disgusting," the woman replied. "That's okay. It's important for him to see what a woman looks like after she's given up shopping, hair appointments, and wine. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.